Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. I'm teaching my interactive media studies class via Miami University of Ohio, and today's guest is Jane Hall of American University and the Fox News Channel. Let's start talking. Let's have questions. Chelsea, did you want to ask the first question?
Sure. We had a discussion earlier about the kind of the graphic nature of the Iraq War compared to the graphic nature of the Vietnam War. My mom was telling me that in the past with Vietnam, there were pictures of charred American soldiers' bodies, and it was just a lot more graphic and vivid than the images we see today. And Nick asked us why we think in the graphic nature of today's media coverage on the war, it has decreased while all the sexual and violent imagery in video games, movie, and TV have increased. And I was wondering your opinion on that.
Okay. Well, I think that a lot of people in the military thought that the media had, quote unquote, lost Vietnam and did not want to repeat that. Now, in fact, if you study it and study people who have studied it, public opinion was turning against the war before the media turned against the war, as often happens. The public was ahead. But that was the perception, so that during subsequent wars, they were determined that the wars would be short. They actually were, you know, the first Gulf War, they pretty much, I think, programmed it to be like...
It was a long weekend.
It was a long weekend. Yep. It was going to be like a video game.
Right.
And we had the allegedly smart bombs. I mean, it was very much about video games. And I was even told that the young pilots had better visual acuity to drop these smart bombs because they were like playing a video game, deadly video game.
Much of which turned out not to be true.
Much of which was not true. So flash forward to the Iraq War. And again, you know, there was this embedding. And this is probably more than you want to know about this. So the idea was, how do we deal? I mean, to be fair to the military, how do you deal with thousands of people who want to cover your war? So they embedded with soldiers. They very much control the imagery. The Bush administration very strongly did not want body bags and soldiers' coffins, flag drape, coming into Dover Air Force Base. So we have been pretty much trying to sanitize war in this country.
But wait, now, when you say we...
Who's this we?
But why does the media put up with that? Because, I mean, you can get these images of battle-scarred and battle-charred bodies and cities in Iraq from Al Jazeera. I mean, it's widely available.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, Fox News doesn't show it, CNN, MSNBC, none of the networks. Why?
Well, it's interesting because I also did a survey of 200 journalists who were in Iraq on the third anniversary of the war. And at the time, there was this incident where there were the three contractors who were killed and their bodies were hanged. Mm-hmm. Charred remains, mm-hmm. and people were revolted by that in this country. I would say cynically that, you know, there was a desire to have people think we could have a war without any casualties. And it ain't so. And it's interesting because I have studied this. During World War II, they kept a lot of imagery away from the public. Then they got worried the public was too complacent. So then they started putting more information out. So it's a push-pull. I think we are into this weird situation where we have live coverage that doesn't necessarily tell you anything. It appears to tell you something. Now, why that relates to video games or how, I don't really know. I mean, I've always thought liberals are more opposed to violent content.
Right.
Conservatives are more opposed to sexual content. I just went to a PG-13 movie with my daughter and was shocked by the level of violence in the promos. You know, I went to see that vampire movie with her.
Twilight,
yeah. Which was already kind of weird. But I prefer the weirdness of, you know, of that to the violence. But that, I'm not sure. I think, again, video games, if you look, I mean, again, I think that's more played... There's more violence, but it's simulated, so there are no consequences. Maybe there is a connection in that there are no consequences.
Well, and it's certainly true that, I mean, governments always wrangle over depictions of war.
Right.
I mean, whether back in the days before photography, but then
right.
before. Do you think embedding, just very briefly, was embedding a good thing or a bad thing, and did it really buy off the journalists by giving them access but under very constrained circumstances?
I think it was a good thing initially because You had a whole generation, and I was sort of educated about this by some of the people I interviewed in that piece, the editor of Army Times, the editor of Defense News, who were not, you know, in the pocket of the military at all. They said to me, you had a whole generation of journalists who didn't know anybody in the military post-Vietnam, who didn't have any appreciation for what our military was up against, partially because we have a voluntary military now. But I think initially it was good, but it ended up being so false. John Donvan, whom I quote in that piece that you all read for Harvard, for the Harvard Journal, said he was unembedded briefly, and he saw that we were not being greeted with dates and flowers, which is what the government had thought we were going to be greeted with by the people there. So it created a false sense that everything was fine, and then the policy, you know, then we did a lot of bad things in the immediate aftermath of taking possession of Iraq.
Well, you know, in the Army Times, it's interesting because I'm sure probably none of you have read the Army Times, but they did a number of long series about the war's effects on soldiers, et cetera. It's a you wouldn't expect it to be a wellspring of kind of independent journalism, but it really was. I mean, so
it really was, and they got into trouble for showing somebody dying who had not yet died, and the Army went after them and cut off access.
Let's go to the next question. Who would like to ask the next question, please?
I'd just like to kind of follow up on that and ask if you think embedding overall was a success and if you think that should be a strategy that we do pursue should there be another conflict, whether that is similar or different than the way the Iraq war went on.
Well, I think embedding, it depends on how you define success. I think it allowed the American people to see the war, or a tiny slice of it, you know, like within the frame of this camera we're talking to. I think it did, as I say, give access, but then I think it created this gee whiz coverage. It created a sense, I wasn't able to document, and I haven't seen, you know, stories. I mean, there was one infamous incident where a freelancer for NBC photographed, I don't know if you all saw this or if you've studied this that much, but a guy from NBC shot footage of a soldier killing somebody who was almost dead. You know, have you seen this? It raid, huge uproar about that he had been, you know, he had done a terrible disservice. I know from the military standpoint, they feel that the media always overplay something, you know, that is a negative and that they don't, you know, play the positive. So it's always a push-pull. I guess I'm saying I don't think it's reality. You can't turn on a camera, as Morley Safer said, and have somebody go, okay, tell me what's going on. You know, I was told, again, by people who covered this, the briefings were lousy. I mean, there was a real attempt to control the information.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because the Bush administration clearly controlled the narrative leading up to the war.
Right, that's true.
And we were talking about this earlier about Judith Miller and people at the New York Times and a couple of other major outlets through access, privileged sources, secret sources, and it was clear that the Bush administration successfully manipulated the narrative of the war, to get into the war on a certain level, but then they really did seem to lose control of it once the occupation began.
Well, they did because you can't deny the reality of an insurgency.
Right. But they also did. I mean, because you hear this from supporters of the war constantly, that the press wouldn't cover the good stuff coming out of Iraq, et cetera. Yeah. But I mean, the Bush administration wasn't having briefings where they were like, okay, here is what we did, and yeah, I mean, you would hear somewhere down a list, we've opened X number of schools or hospitals, but, you know, I mean, they did not get the story out, whatever they said.
Well, they didn't, and, you know, I think they took a lot of heat. You have to remember there's always a strong pressure about whether it's we or they, you know. Or is it we who are going into Iraq, or is it, you know, are you as a journalist part of the war effort, or are you separate? There's a lot of pressure after 9/11 to attack people for being at all skeptical about this war. I think it's going to go down as one of the worst episodes in the media. The lack of sourcing, the lack of looking as to whether there was debate.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Next question.
Hi. We actually had a more personal question for you.
You're the first lady, by the way.
Good,
this semester.
I know.
So we'll talk about lady stuff.
Oh, good. Okay.
In your articles, you talked about media crushes on certain political figures, and how writing, whether even if it's meant to look up objective, can turn out sort of skewed. So we were wondering what your own personal politics were.
Oh, I'm not going to say.
Why aren't you going to say?
You know, I still consider myself, well, first of all, I teach. Do you tell these guys your politics? I suppose they know.
I mean, I've run a libertarian website.
Right, okay. I try to present, well, I still consider myself a journalist. And I think that, you know, you can probably, you know, discern what my point of view is. Mm-hmm. When I first started doing media commentary, I was still a reporter, and I had to be even more circumspect. I mean, there's certain things I feel pretty strongly about. You know, I mean, I feel strongly about the depiction of women, which, mm-hmm. you know, I was strong on feeling, and early, I think, on picking up how sexist a lot of the coverage mm-hmm. was on Hillary Clinton, no matter what you think about her. But
right.
I'm uncomfortable.
And Sarah Palin.
Yeah. I'm uncomfortable saying what my personal politics
what,
are.
Can you, with, you don't have to tell us them, but why are you uncomfortable about that? Because it's not like they're not there, right?
Well, I
guess
wouldn't
your readers like to know?
Well, I've told you, for example, what I think of the Bush administration's mm-hmm. attempt to cover, you know, to control coverage. Mm-hmm. And yet when I went to write this article, I interviewed a whole lot of people, including the spokesman mm-hmm. for the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my commentary, I like to think, is based on reporting. I mean, mm-hmm. and I also interview a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you all, if this was part of what we talked about or what you, you know, in the last couple of years I've been doing forums at American University. They're on the public mm-hmm. radio station. And I have Republicans and Democrats alike. Mm-hmm. And I don't particularly want to be viewed as a person who's got a political agenda.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Although, you know, I don't think anybody's wholly objective.
Right. Well, you know, we've talked a lot about this, about the distinctions between objectivity and fairness. And objectivity is probably something that can never be established. And I would argue that it's better not to fake it.
Yeah.
But then fairness is a journalistic virtue, I think, where you're not misrepresenting people.
Well, no. I think there is a distinction. Yeah. And I'm sure if you all have looked back at the history of journalism, you know that it used to be that we had, you know, left-wing and right-wing
right.
publications. And objectivity is, in part comes from wire services. Did mm-hmm. y'all talk about that at all? It comes in part from people saying, well, you know, we're going to tell just the facts. Mm-hmm. Now, that is fallacious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it, you know, there aren't two sides to some stories.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do apartheid right or wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah, I mean, certain things are true. And so I don't believe in let's go get somebody who's in favor
right.
of something just to prove that we're objective.
Right.
But I do think you can, how can I say this delicately? As a journalist, I know what people can do to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could take this, mash it up, and make me look terrible, mm-hmm. and make me look left-wing, right-wing, whatever.
Right.
So all I'm counting on you to be is, you know, true to what actually happened,
right.
true to what I said, or seek out other points of view. I guess the other thing, the reason I don't like to talk about my politics is I teach
mm-hmm.
journalists. I, you know, and
so do you feel like you would be putting your students, because you have a relationship which is not equal, I mean, in terms of power, that you would be forcing them to kowtow to your politics?
Oh,
or,
I hope not.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm that fearful.
Okay.
But,
okay.
I mean, I know, I've talked to other professors about this. I mean, you know, the former editor of the Washington Post, Lynn Downey, mm-hmm. famously says he doesn't vote, right?
Yep.
I mean, you can carry it right out the window.
Right.
I just think it's better. I mean, I'm not masquerading. If you were mm-hmm. in my class, you would know how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hide how I feel.
Okay. So you're like a communist, right?
I'm a communist,
okay.
yes.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm a libertarian. Very
yeah,
well. Very
yeah,
well.
Under deep, deep cover.
Deep,
this
deep
is.
Black, okay. black operations.
Yeah. Let's go to the next question. Yeah.
Up in that question, just because I'd like to say that I did think that your writing was very straightforward and doesn't include your politics, but I was just wondering, with that kind of goal of being nonpartisan, is it kind of hard to appear on a station that's particularly has a sort of conservative slant or a political agenda, maybe some say?
Yeah, maybe some say. That's the old journalist dodge. Some people say...
There are those.
There are those who say... Well, let me talk about that. I mean, I have been I've been on Fox for a long time on a show that I'm actually, you know, feel has had balance on it. We had... And I hate that word, you know, balance. I mean, again, what does that mean?
You're just saying the slogan, right?
It's No, balance, but I mean, right? When we first started out... We had Neil Gabler, who missed no opportunity, frankly. Not no opportunity, but often was very critical of the Bush administration. I've been very critical.
And of Fox.
And of Fox. Yeah. I've been critical of Fox. So I've always sort of, my joke is to my friends who question my doing. I mean, I don't have any question about being on a show where we've got Jim Pinkerton, who is, I think, a libertarian.
Yeah, more or less.
We've got Cal Thomas, who comes from a pretty conservative standpoint, but not always.
Right.
And Neil Gabler. And we haven't had, that seat has not been filled recently yet. We've had David Korn. We've had Juan Williams. I guess David Korn is the closest.
I mean,
he's
the
editor.
Hard
of,
left.
Well, I don't know if I'd characterize him. But,
oh, I think so.
But so I think on that show to my mind is like any other roundup show. I did decide to go on, and for the last 2 years, I'm not doing it anymore, but I was debating Bernie Goldberg on O'Reilly.
Yeah, explain to them who
Bernie Goldberg wrote this book called Bias, and he made a big splash because he was at CBS and he said CBS was full of liberals and that they had an agenda. And he made a big splash in the book. Some of the charges, I think, were probably valid. And I went on the O'Reilly show and, you know, my joke is that I was evangelizing for the mainstream media because, frankly, you know, that's 2.5 million people a night and a lot of famous journalists at news organizations have quietly thanked me and quietly talked to me, called me back and said, well, I don't want to go on there, but thank God you're going on to try to defend this. I mean, I talked to Seymour Hersh. I've talked to the editors of the LA Times, the New York Times, NBC News. I felt that I felt I was playing a role.
Well, you can set up those shows. And I think I sent you a clip of one of them, but that O'Reilly and Goldberg would just give examples of just how biased
the media is,
and then you would.
I would try to defend the media, and unfortunately, the times when O'Reilly, you know, got pretty over the top with me, are the things that some people remember. But he was criticizing some of my friends. Those are my politics. Don't mess with my friends.
Okay.
No, I mean he was criticizing Bill Moyers, and he was criticizing Neil Gabler, actually. So I felt that I began to develop, this is a long-winded answer. People began, I mean, I got on planes a couple of times where literally this very nice older Republican woman, one specific instance, said, dear, come sit with me. And I said, do I know you, ma'am? And she said, I didn't like the way he treated you last night. I don't agree with you, but, you know, and there was a lot of people that wrote in and said, at least they had heard what I was trying to do. They often, I felt, would cherry pick. They would say NBC News never covers the good news out of Iraq. And I would go back and say, wait a minute, you set a time frame, and the day before they did a positive story. So I have felt it was worth doing. I don't, you know, you can make your own judgments about what you think about that. I mean, if you don't feel you're getting your point across, ultimately, you know, is it worth doing?
Do you think it's accurate, as Cassie was saying, to characterize Fox News Channel as a right-wing?
No, I don't.
Or a right-leaning or Republican-friendly? I mean, these are the charges.
I think you have to separate their reporting from their commentary. I think the people who covered Obama, you know, were considered pretty fair.
Yeah.
I think that Obama would say, and you know, and Obama went on and did an interview with Bill O'Reilly that probably was helpful to him.
Yeah, certainly.
I mean, I'm not here to, you know, defend or not defend Fox, but I do think you have to make a differentiation between what they say
even,
and their
commentary. I don't know if you guys watch how often, but I mean, even on the commentary shows, and I, you know, and as somebody whose politics are not conventionally right or left. Fox has been very good to Reason and to libertarians with small L's. And, you know, their commentary shows, I mean, when you look at the Sunday show, and they have like Mara Liasson on,
right,
and Juan Williams. And, I mean, they have liberals, they have conservatives, and they have, you know, some, you know, kooky people from other places. So,
well, yeah, and I mean, their answer is that they've had more variety than MSNBC.
Yeah, which I think is probably true.
And it's interesting, you know. I don't know. You'll have to make your own judgment about that. It's certainly been interesting. The weekend show I've been on forever. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody could say has a particular.
No, and it's slant. It's one of the things I find kind of surprising about it is that show is not more widely copied, because it performs a very good function, and it's a very lively show.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
There's only one other, CNN's Reliable Sources, and frankly, I don't know why more people haven't done it.
Yeah.
I don't think most media organizations, I used to cover the media for the LA Times, most media organizations do not want to criticize other media organizations.
Yeah.
There's a reticence. Hmm.
Let's go to another question. Who would like to ask the next question? Megan?
Kind of a change in subject, but we've heard you mention that you think at any point that the media could kind of turn on Obama, and I was just kind of wondering what you think a candidate or any politician could do to kind of like overcome or avoid that type of like vulnerability, or how they can gain success through that.
Well, I guess what I was trying to say was I think there is an inevitable arc of coverage. And somebody, interestingly, who was pretty up close, said to me that reporters hadn't actually fallen in love as much with Obama as their editors, at least according to what this person said to me. I think that the idea of Obama, the idea of change, the idea of newness, the idea of the first, African-American, plus the way he ran this phenomenal internet-based young appeal campaign, I think people did get caught up in it. I do think a lot of the coverage ultimately, if you look at the Cindy McCain profile in the New York Times versus the Michelle Obama coverage, or the Michelle Obama Us magazine versus the Sarah Palin, sex lies and whatever it was about her daughter's pregnancy, it was pretty blatant at times. I think that there's
that,
a certain...
That the Obamas that, were... I
the
mean,
Obamas
that the
were...
Is in love
were
with.
Well, and that, yep. that Cindy McCain was getting rougher coverage.
Right.
So I guess I'm not answering your question. I think there's an inevitable arc. I think that to show their independence, reporters are going to turn more skeptical. I think that my gut tells me... I think George W. Bush, part of that whole 2000 article I wrote, and I was so tickled, I don't know if I sent it to you, but mybarackobama.com did a piece recently, a blogger said, was citing my article from 2000, saying the media let John McCain get away with a lot of stuff, unlike what people have said. He certainly attacked the media. So there's a cycle there, and I think that Obama may not really, I think he's going to need the mainstream media, but I think that he's got this whole network. He may try to bypass the media. I think it's going to be interesting to see happens.
What do you mean when you say bypass the media?
Well, I mean, if you've got this change.gov thing that he's got going, which is sort of the successor to, Obama, elect Obama,
right.
He's got a ready network of people whom he can say, contact your congressman.
Right, or he can send text messages
to. I mean, he's sort of our first internet. Well,
right.
Howard Dean was first campaign. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I think that he will still sit down with the mainstream media, just as Sarah Palin did to her dismay, just as, he felt the need to do. I mean, they still reach the biggest audience. But I guess I'm not at all sure that he is going to feel the need to bandy about, there are famous press conferences with Kennedy bandying about. In a funny way, I'm not sure he feels the need to do that.
That's interesting.
I don't know. I'm guessing.
Do you buy the idea? I mean, a lot of people talk about how Ronald Reagan bypassed the media.
Yeah.
I mean, he used the mainstream media, broadcast media, which was really the only thing going on then, but that he managed to speak past the media that was hostile to him and his ideas.
Oh, yeah.
And then Bill Clinton, who was clearly beloved by the media when he got into office immediately. I mean, he had the most disastrous first 2 years.
Yeah.
And the press turned on him.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, if the media is left out by Obama, will they turn on him or will they desperately, you know, suck up to him to get access?
I don't know. Maybe a little of both.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, so much for the myth of the liberal media. I mean, George W. Bush was viewed as a compassionate conservative, and he mm-hmm. had nicknames for all the guys and gals on the plane. Mm-hmm. And Al Gore, as I said, was viewed as Mr. Stiff, Mr. Liar, Mr. Prevaricator. And I think that, I mean, Bill Clinton, I would say, probably would say to you, again, so much for the liberal mm-hmm. media. Bill Clinton got hit very mm-hmm. early on. I think the media are often out to prove that they're not liberal, and so
right.
they do backflips.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's interesting about both Bill Clinton and George Bush, and I don't think Obama is like this, but if you turn the sound off and you see them mixing with people, they mm-hmm. have an enormous comfort level in every social situation. Mm-hmm. They literally will touch you know, black people or white people, men or women, and they're just comfortable in a way that a lot of politicians. McCain is super stiff. I think Obama seems genuinely uncomfortable around people. You know, it's, I mean, I think Bush was pulling, you know, some of that Clinton magic of like being good. You know, he knows how to press the flesh. But
yeah, I think Bush does know how to press the flesh.
Well,
you know,
let's have another question.
You said in your article about Al Gore and Bush that Bush kind of adopted the McCain style mm-hmm. of interacting with the press.
Right.
I was wondering if you were thinking that like the age differentiation from then till now hurt McCain, or why he wasn't as successful as Bush was with the same, but with his practices with the media.
Well, you know, there was a time that the media had a total love fest. That's what was the tremendous irony. I do feel that we're
With
John McCain, yeah. Sorry. I do feel like we're in this sort of weird ahistorical thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody remembers 8 years ago anymore, mm-hmm. much less World War II. I mean, you don't have to have lived through World War II to know when it was. But
or the Great Depression.
Or the Great Depression.
I mean, the discussion of economic situations now that, like, retardedly compared to the Great Depression.
Yeah,
just
when
bizarre.
Unemployment was totally
was
like 20% or something.
Yeah.
Well, I guess my point is the media, well, McCain even joked that the media were his base. Mm-hmm. And he had this 24-hour kind of MTV real world 24/7 access. Talk to me, I'm a maverick. He genuinely was a maverick. And I, you know, interviewed him when I was still at the LA Times. He was appealing to, you know, the storyline, the narrative was very appealing. I think that he did get older. I do think personally that, well, I think that some of the people around him didn't run the best campaign for him. Underscore, as Dan Rather would say, underscore, underline. And I think that, you know, he may have, you know, like Hillary Clinton, he was sort of like in front of a movement. You know, he was in front of a train. Obama was sort of a train coming down the tracks. And I think my gut just tells me that McCain didn't really know how to deal with it. And also, I think McCain moved away from some of his positions. And I would really fault the media for not saying, you know, here's how he moved. Mm-hmm. You know, he was smeared by certainly a stealth campaign. And then he turned around and, in my opinion, tried to smear. Okay, now you're knowing my politics.
Okay,
my ethics.
Wait. Okay,
he
so
turned
you're
around
talking
in his campaign.
In 2000,
somebody, he lost to Bush, and then
right.
he turned around and embraced Bush.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, and he interesting positions on torture, interesting mm-hmm. positions on immigration.
Yeah. Well, I actually think in the general campaign, you know, part of it was also you're doing two things where in a primary system or a primary season, you're appealing to the base or more committed voters who tend to be ideologically further out from the middle than the general election. And McCain, I think, suffered by not sticking to his immigration rhetoric, which would have been more popular with a general election. And then it makes him look kind of weak or waffling. And,
well, it does, except, you know, he wasn't right enough.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why everybody thinks he picked or Palin was picked.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your career arc. Can you give us a quick recitation of when where you started
in
and
the
how you ended up?
Yeah. I was born in Abilene, Texas. I used to say I was from near Dallas, and I've always laughed about that since I left. It's 200 miles away, but we used to, you know, drive a lot in those days to Dallas. I'm from Texas. I went off to college in California at Mills College. I then came back to Texas, worked on the Daily Texan, which was kind of like the Daily Cal, the University of Texas publication. And then I went
I think it's like the largest, or it's certainly one of the most prestigious.
It's a great student newspaper, and I covered the city council. I had a great time with that. And I went to Columbia Journalism School, and where I think I did develop a sense of anti-media elitism.
What were you doing at University of Texas?
I was studying English, my joke is I wanted to be a poet, and my father said, honey, what else can you do besides be a poet? I was very interested in politics, very interested in media, and I went to Columbia and then worked on an alternative newspaper in Richmond, Virginia.
So that's like an alt-weekly
It was an alternate weekly.
Okay. What was it called?
It was called the Richmond Mercury.
Okay.
And Frank Rich at the New York Times was one of the founders of it. So I went down there and made no money and did a lot of exposés of Richmond politics. And then we went bust pretty soon. And then I went back to Texas and tried to get a job from Texas and wanted to go back to New York. Eventually came back to New York and worked at TV Guide magazine. And
what were you doing at
TV Guide? I was writing a column. I was like 22 years old. I had this column, TV Guide. I know this all seems like ancient history. TV Guide at the time had a circulation of 22 million. It was like amazing. And I was a photo editor and I was a columnist. And I wrote a lot about PBS programming and cable. And then I left there to be editor of a trade magazine about cable television. Got to cover Ted Turner and a whole bunch of interesting Buccaneers. And then I was recruited to go. I tell my students this story, and they're always comforted by this. I don't know. I can't see whether you guys are comforted. But they always go, wow, that's random, which I think means they don't feel so bad that maybe their lives may be random. But it wasn't that random. I was always interested in media. But I kept being hired at popular publications. And People Magazine hired me to be in charge of their television coverage. And at the time, both of these publications were a lot more serious. So I was, you know, at one point being introduced as she does the serious stuff in People Magazine. I guess there's some way.
What was the big story that you did at People?
Well, I did a lot of profiles of news anchors. Peter Jennings and Dan Rather.
Did you do a Jessica Savage story? Were you there then?
You know, that was before I was there. But I did a lot of writing about the news. I think the best piece I did was an interview with Mike Wallace. Well, and Walter Cronkite, both about the
country. And you realize they have no idea who those people are.
Oh, guys, you don't know. Walter Cronkite was the CBS News anchor during Vietnam and since, when they owned the world. But at the time, I got him to talk about how he felt about cutbacks and layoffs. I mean, the world has really changed. Mike Wallace, the 60 Minutes guy, do you guys know who he is? He was being sued by a Vietnam general, General William S. Worland, about a documentary that was pretty flawed that they'd done. So people always expected to do a piece about their wardrobe. And then the best piece I did was on, the most fun was on David Letterman. I did a cover story early on. So I was an editor there. And then I went to work for a television operation that was started by the then chairman of NBC and a guy named Steve Friedman with Gannett, and we reproduced. I was kidding with your professor that I wanted to do the Nation magazine on TV. I wanted to do something about opinion TV. Did some specials, did some programming on that with a pilot with a woman named Beverly Sills, whom you probably, they won't know either, a great opera star. And a special family magazine special. And then I went to work for the LA Times, where I was really happy. And I worked there for 9 years. and
I
was covering the media in New York, and I was writing a lot about ethics in the news, and it was really fun. Enjoyed it. I was a finalist for the Pulitzer. I wrote about the Disney ABC merger. I was always at the time I felt that my coverage did matter because the broadcast networks would at least be embarrassed if you pointed out that they'd done something.
Right.
Now I think the world is just so different.
Do you think one of the
So anyway, then I came down to AU.
Okay. And so then you left the LA Times to
I left the LA
American
Times
University.
To come down to the university.
Yeah. And at American University, are you, just very quickly, are you expected to publish in academic journals and popular, or how do they work that?
Well, that's a very good question. When I came there, we've sort of tried, as the School of Communication, to establish that you can do creative, scholarly, and professional work. To get tenure, I was told, be sure you write for some refereed academic journals. So that piece I'm very proud of about the future of war and war reporting, I spent, you know, 6 weeks on that and was paid nothing. That really troubled me as a journalist. The interviews I did with Tom Brokaw and Howard Dean for Columbia Journalism Review, those were considered semi-scholarly.
Right.
So I wrote a lot of pieces for them. I wrote a lot. And then, you know, what I did in television and then what I began to do on the local NPR station was considered part of the mix, but none of it would have gotten... I just think it's still a book-centric art.
Right.
I didn't try to write a book, which was probably a good idea because I'm supposed to be writing a book right now.
What are you writing
about? I'm writing about politics and the media.
Okay. Does anybody have a question at this point?
What are you guys going to do? I want to know. Does this microphone work?
Yes, it does.
They
turn it off. Okay.
What do you guys want to do?
If your commentary and what you did for the LA Times, was it opinion? Was it commentary?
It was reporting.
It was reporting.
But, you know, I mean, again, I hope I'm not seeming to contradict myself. I used to joke that my beat was how could you? That was my beat. I'd call him up and go, wait a minute, you just did this. And, you know...
What's an example?
Well, let me think of a good example. Well, one was I wrote a lot about the cutbacks. I wrote about... I mean, this is all... It's all is going to seem... Let me think what would be a good thing. I felt I was pretty, in my heart, strong about the need for good broadcast news at a time when cable... And I also wrote early on about CNN.
Why do we need good broadcasting?
Well, I mean, it's such a long story here. At the time that I was writing, I was there from 89 to 98. So 1990 was when CNN started. So I wrote, you know, about CNN and their coverage. I would write about things like, it was mostly about ethics, sometimes about business. But I'm trying to think, there was a scandal called Operation Tailwind, right as I was leaving the LA Times, where CNN had a documentary about a black operation that, again, they didn't quite have the goods. And so I was interviewing people about that. I interviewed First Amendment attorneys about, for example, I went on a ride-along with Dan Rather early on where we were going into a crack den. My joke was, I didn't know I could die on the show business beat. You know, I had this bulletproof vest on. And I wrote the story, and then I began to question about the legality and the ethics of going into, you know, crack dens and going into various places. The media were very big on these ride-alongs, and the DEA and the ATF and everybody was taking them along. So I began to write about, was this legal? Was this a good thing? You know, so it was sort of that kind of thing. I wrote a lot about business when Disney and ABC merged. You know, I wrote the stories.
And this was at a time really when cable had become fully
cable had
spread through. I mean, the technology was in every town in America. Well, and the cable networks were really coming into their own.
Yeah, cable. Yeah. I mean, CNN's big thing was obviously during the first Gulf War.
The first Gulf War, and then also a number of the channels with the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about that, too. I mean, I wrote about, you know, sort of what you would call jokingly the semiotics of O.J. Mm-hmm. Simpson.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote about why culturally everybody was riveted. What was that about?
Mm-hmm. What was your answer in one sentence or less?
Aspect ratio.
Yeah, okay. That sounds
Do you guys know what I mean by that? Did you know, I learned in the course of this, I mean, it's partially the coin of the realm. It's a communal experience. Mm-hmm. It's racism. Mm-hmm. It's Desdemona and Othello.
It's sexism.
It's everything else.
I mean, it had sex, murder, sports stars, a glimpse into Hollywood high life type of things.
So. Right. But I did meet a guy, interview a guy who told me that the reason, part of the reason why people are riveted to television is that you can take it all in without moving. A film forces you to move.
Hmm. Yeah.
So you can be hypnotized by TV. So you didn't know that, did you guys?
Well, do you think, you know, you were talking about, you seem to, as a journalist, you have a bad reaction whenever a journalist anywhere is fired, right? Or when there are cutbacks. But do you think, I mean, clearly news organizations exist very differently than they did 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Do you think that we're in an age of good media opportunities and that, you know, as a consumer, are we better off or are we worse off? Or, what, you know, are you bullish on media?
Well, I'm optimistic and depressed simultaneously. If I can be
kind of bipolar.
In my points of view. I don't mean to make any jokes about that, but I think that serious investigative journalism that takes money and time is going to be hard for a blogger to do.
Right.
And I've talked to people at the networks about coverage of the Iraq War. And it costs like $1 million a month to have the security that's needed there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are very few news organizations that can and will spend the money to be there, especially when people are tuning it out now. So, you know, look at the Walter Reed story. I don't know if y'all saw that, but Pulitzer Prize-winning story by two women, Dana Priest and Ann Hall, who went over to Walter Reed Hospital, spent months incognito, which you wonder how they could spend months incognito, blew open the fact that we were treating our veterans, the U.S. was treating our veterans terribly. You've got to free somebody up financially to go do that. And you've got to have a megaphone that then people notice. Now, I do think, so that's the part of me that's worried. L.A. Times, where I used to work, is being run into the ground by an owner that, you know, does not care, as far as I can tell, about news. So there's that. New York Times stock is down. They're losing advertising. They're, you know, Craigslist has taken all the classifieds. Over here we have you guys, online opportunities, multimedia, layers of storytelling, opportunities, opinion magazines like yours, you know, getting virally forwarded.
Right.
Ideas being forwarded. My feeling is people who are, you know, in their mid-50s are taking the buyouts, and then my students are pretty quickly going to be running news organizations. I would assume if you all are going to be journalists. I mean, I feel a real burden as a teacher to try to talk about ethics, and try to send people out. And I just communicated with one of my former students who was on the air with India Television for 63 hours. She was in my class 5 years ago. She's from India, you know, and I emailed her and I was like, oh, my God, you know. Now, that's a particular circumstance.
Right.
But you guys, your generation has, this generation has enormous opportunities. I do think it's going to be hard to finance investigative journalism. Some people think a nonprofit model is going to be the only way.
And certainly, I mean, that's, you mentioned David Korn. He's the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones now, which is a magazine funded by a nonprofit, similar to Reason. And, you know, I mean, they won a National Magazine Award last year in part on the strength of their continuing investigative journalism. So.
Right. So there's There's hope out there, I hope. I mean, I think it's going to be hard. There's not a lot of call for what's, quote unquote, good for people, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, I do think the only, I will say another hopeful thing is the interest in this election pushed a lot of crummy news, you know, tabloid mm-hmm. news. The networks did very well covering the election. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What they'll do for an encore.
Yeah, that's actually, and well, yeah, I mean, because I know that, like, the vice presidential debate did extremely well.
Yeah, millions of people.
And Obama, as well as McCain's, I mean, it generated more viewership than expected. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I keep wanting to ask you guys.
Here,
you
we
think?
Only have a couple minutes.
It's very frustrating. It's like a one-way mirror.
Yes, believe me. let's talk very quickly about some gender issues, because that's something that you write about.
Yeah.
Is the media workplace, has it gotten better for women over the course of your career? And have we reached a point where it's not so much an issue, or what's left to kind of to fix in terms of gender relations in the workplace?
In
media?
Oh, okay.
I mean, because clearly, it seems very clear that both to Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin that a lot of the coverage was either covertly or implicitly sexist when it wasn't explicitly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and see, that's where, yeah, I mean, yes, and to go back to our earlier discussion, Chris Matthews, you know, was a commentator and worked for an arm of NBC News, so mm-hmm. people had to sort of separate that. But I'm not as current on the workplace. Unfortunately, I think that the press for women and minorities and more diversity in the newsroom, well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't really, I think women still are not in levels of management mm-hmm. in the media as much. I mean, again, coming up, you see more female journalism students. Mm-hmm. But if you start looking at the top, it's still, I would say, the publishers mm-hmm. of publications. I mean, Arianna Huffington, you know,
right.
the new Graham Eyre, who mm-hmm. is the head of the, is a young woman. Mm-hmm. But I think, I'm afraid that as we hit tough times, the press for, you know, let's be sure we're having diversity and equality, I don't know. There were a lot of gains that were made by people bringing lawsuits, mm-hmm. you know, in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, we, you know, along with ethics, I would argue, you know, one of the things that you're clearly bringing to your students and is really worth thinking about is that sense of history. You expect journalists, because, you know, to know what the past was like, but they have really bad amnesia.
Yeah, they do.
I mean, really, where people who covered the 2000 election don't remember it or recall it half the time. And I think that along with having a sense of what you're trying to accomplish is also that being embedded in history, so that World War II is not just some vague blip that doesn't matter anymore, but you can, you know, that's really something that will help you as a journalist or in any kind of work situation. Thank you, Jane. Our time's over, and, you know, wonderful talking with you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.